Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Golson, and thank all of you for your very warm reception and attendance here this afternoon. Just a couple of minutes ago, I was sitting in that chair with the very awesome sensation that I was just about to be called upon to speak, and I didn't have my speech. But the speech got here, and I'm glad to be here with you. This morning, as I was having breakfast, I'm staying at one of your dorms, at one of your colleges, and I went to breakfast at the cafeteria. And something very flattering happened to me. One of the students whom I invited to the lecture afterwards looked at me as I sat beside him and looked at my my dress, and he says, "Hey man, what's the occasion?" I hope he's here somewhere. We're having some company outside. There are some familiar chants. I have heard them outside La Fortaleza, Governor's Mansion, sometimes until the wee hours of the morning. It's part of Puerto Rico's panorama, and we will get into it as we proceed with the lecture. Freedom is the basic test of all human progress. At this late date of recorded history, most of mankind, unfortunately, remains unfree. Claims of advancement add up to hyperbole in the face of the fact that the powerful prison of poverty incarcerates the overwhelming majority of the world's population. More than 2 billion people know little economic progress and less economic power. Instead, they're jailed in the repressive environment of joblessness, overpopulation, pollution, rural stagnation, overcrowdedness, and, worst of all, hopelessness. Having broken no laws of any national state or the state of nature, the impoverished masses, in quotes, many of whom live in our midst, are cruelly locked up, victims of the most subtle form of tyranny. They languish, untried and neglected. They yearn to play a part of the liberating process of economic growth and economic equity. Those fortunate few outside the prison walls who have the well-being and wherewithal to share and redistribute the good earth's elemental wealth on the basis of fairness and social justice are making only the slightest effort to free their brothers and their sisters. Finding formulas to swing open the gates of poverty, of poverty's prison, is freedom's greatest challenge in the world today. People around the globe applaud the words and the worth of the world's present-day symbol of freedom, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. In the book, The Gulag Archipelago, he tells of those people imprisoned in Stalin's Russia, hostages of a police state, not accused of anything at all personally, those peaceful inhabitants not even listed by name and taken off to destruction only for the sake of terror. Solzhenitsyn's recent revelations of the politics of his own society and his personal courage in trying to open up windows in order that freedom's winds can blow through the state-controlled structure of the Soviet Union demonstrate graphically that mankind does resist such political tyranny. But where is mankind's concern and intolerance of the fate of the two-thirds of the world's humans who suffer from the worldwide system of economic oppression? Necessitous men are not free men. It is my belief that mankind can neither tolerate political nor economic Gulag archipelagos. Reaction and resistance to economic tyranny is overdue. Economic liberation calls. International economic development is a necessity. The desire for political and economic freedom is shared universally. Individuals long for this genuine freedom. Governments that are responsive seek and encourage such freedom. Countries want associations with other countries that enhance political and economic freedom. The fact is, however, that although both individuals and government desire conditions that encourage open expression and fair and fruitful economic intercourse, efforts towards individual liberty and equality are frequently thwarted by mankind's own passivity, undermining thus the global spirit of being free. A look at how people exist today on each continent, subcontinent, and islands scattered throughout the seven seas shows the extent of oppression. Never before in history has there been so much political sovereignty and yet so little political freedom. Never before in history has there been so much economic plenty to enjoy plus the means to make more, yet so little economic freedom. It is a fact that the disparity between those who have and the more than two-thirds who dwell in day in and day out in backward economic circumstances increases rather than diminishes. Simultaneously, a realization on the part of those who feel the inequity accelerates. Anger becomes keener. Expectations no longer rise. What does rise is the widespread acceptability to have and to take by force. America's founding fathers proclaimed to the whole world that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights. The pages of history are filled with attempts by freedom fighters to provide equal opportunities and rights. Only infrequently has this goal been met, and when it has, it most often has been political freedom. But to have one without the other still leaves man unfree. In the year 1974, it is necessary then for those who ardently love freedom more than personal pursuit to commit themselves to overcome the obstacles imprisoning our brothers and sisters on the archipelago Solzhenitsyn described as that deformed world, and to find ways to let our people go. Adequate programs of progress are not enough. Not only must new means and a new willingness be found to manage the Earth environment and to distribute its resources more widely, but all of us in positions of leadership must dedicate ourselves totally towards stimulating the human spirit so that the doors bolted shut for centuries can be unlocked and human affairs radically reformed. Otherwise, the power of poverty to repress those who dwell within will maintain its ancient hold on the billions of hostages. True freedom is at stake. Somerset Maugham put this point poignantly. If a nation values anything more than freedom, he wrote, it will lose its freedom. And the irony of it is that if it is comfort or money that it values more, it will lose that too. The practical lesson is clear. as men in past epochs have heroically shed blood to attain the precious goal of political freedom, the current course of heroics needs to focus on attaining the precious goal of economic freedom. Indeed, daily headlines of kidnapping and international terrorism do not disguise the fact that rich-poor skirmishes are already in process in the developed countries. These encounters will inevitably rise over the next few years. Provocations will be performed for the purpose of achieving comfort and money for the many who do not have either economic well-being or economic equity or both. In providing the poor opportunities for freedom in the near future, therefore, we strengthen the possibility of preserving freedom to those that have. Like Jefferson, I believe it is imperative to do eternal battle against every form of terror and tyranny. The best way that I know to fight is to fight for the right for the people themselves to participate in making the decisions on how to best launch economic efforts that will improve their own welfare. And I hasten to add that not just a few countries, but all peoples together must move forward in the implementation of new global goals of human happiness and well-being. I would like now to turn and look briefly at the battles for popular democracy and economic growth that have been waged for a generation in Puerto Rico, and then focus on what course the fight for full freedom, that is, economic equity and participating in a global economic system, will take in the future. How Puerto Rico accomplished its economic transformation in such a short period of time, and what my country now strives for, I believe, have profound importance, not only for Puerto Ricans, but for other peoples in the world community as well. Puerto Rico has very unique characteristics, and therefore, it does not and cannot present itself as a model to be copied. Rather, the men and women of my country are deeply involved in the dynamics of providing jobs and justice for themselves. Perhaps in that process, there's a message or two worth passing on to the world community. How we got on freedom's road and accelerated our journey and where we're headed is the tale that I want to tell. The course of action chosen by Puerto Ricans to escape from its imprisoning archipelago began to take shape just before the Second World War. At that time, Puerto Rico lay forgotten and stagnant as a viable society, labeled as the poorhouse of the Caribbean. Despair gripped most of the population. Others were even worse off psychologically, being beyond alienation as it is now understood, for to be alienated from something, it is first necessary to have been in some measure a part of it. In certain areas of the island, there were people who never belonged to anything in their lifetime from which they could withdraw. A contemporary poet, pessimistic at the fate of his fellow countrymen, described the situation this way: "Pity, Lord, pity on my poor nation, where my poor people will die of nothing." However, in 1938, a new political organization was founded. The Popular Democratic Party, led by Luis Muñoz Marín, struck a chord among the citizenry when it called upon individuals to be a part of their own society and to find solutions to improve their own lives. Instead of focusing on political status, as traditional colonial politics prescribed, the party pledged to face squarely the island's most pressing problems. Muñoz rallied the masses providing the people an opportunity to participate in politics directly and without fear. At meetings, again and again, Muñoz told the listeners, in the face of a Puerto Rican custom up to that time, of selling their votes for certain amounts of money. Nobody, said Muñoz, can really blame you for selling your vote, but you must look at this thing clearly. Do you want $2 or do you want justice? You can't have both. And this time, you have to make a choice. Vote for me and see what happens. With the free vote and the luxury of hope added on, the Popular Democratic Party won, finding the road on which to travel towards freedom and beginning Puerto Rico's modern era. The Puerto Rican government as a whole has worked to reverse the population's backward circumstances. Operation Bootstrap, the program chosen to overcome poverty's oppression, represents a clear consensus of the Puerto Rican people to deal with massive dependency and a dynamic effort to diversify and develop our economy. Government's central role in the country's economic growth and industrialization expresses the national will. Integrating freedom with public planning has provided popular participation plus greater opportunities for personal originality and leadership, a phenomenon not thought possible for us during the first half of the 20th century, but it is a reality in the 70s. July 1952 witnessed the authorization of a constitution and the creation of the Commonwealth relationship between the peoples of Puerto Rico and the United States. This novel and far-reaching association within the direction of an autonomous movement that started in the last quarter of the 19th century was the basis upon which Puerto Ricans chose to break loose from the bonds of poverty that had enchained the whole country for centuries. It is the system by which Puerto Ricans have fully and voluntarily chosen for the purpose of governing themselves. The essential thrust of the economic compact involves a common market and fiscal autonomy. Freedom is evaluated by the extent to which a people influence the efforts of government to work for the greatest good for the greatest number. In order to break out from behind poverty's bars, Puerto Rico decided that traditional political symbols of sovereignty, such as flags and flagships, were not sufficient means to liberate a people from the overwhelming misery in their midst. The discouraging experience of the new nations that have emerged over the last two decades clearly demonstrates this point. Legal sovereignty without the minimum of material well-being does not satisfy the impoverished masses of the world. The overwhelming majority of the voters, taking issue with the cry of one of Puerto Rico's earliest and most popular nationalists, José de Diego, who described sovereignty as the chief and primary liberty of nations, rejected the tempting emotions of narrow nationalism. It was felt that the political-economic combination of freedom provides Puerto Rico, considering its geographic and other realities, was the best mechanism to free ourselves fully. Experiencing an elastic political association and a dynamic economic linkage presents to the world a new form of freedom and international community. In March 1953, the United States government informed the United Nations that it had decided to cease to transmit information on Puerto Rico under Article 73E of the United Nations Charter. The grounds were that its new status removed Puerto Rico from the category of non-self-governing territories. The government's supporting memorandum stated, Puerto Rico has voluntarily entered into the relationship with the United States, which it has chosen to describe as a commonwealth. After the United Nations Committee had considered the relevant documentation, discussed the issue, and concluded that the transmission of information on Puerto Rico was no longer required, the General Assembly voted to concur in the decision. Its resolution expressed the General Assembly's recognition that in the framework of their Constitution, and I'm quoting from the resolution of the United Nations, in the framework of their Constitution and of the compact agreed upon with the United States of America, the people of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico have been invested with attributes of political sovereignty, which clearly identify the status of self-government attained by the Puerto Rican people as that of an autonomous political entity. Thus, the World's Political Assembly conferred the Charter of International Legitimacy to Puerto Rico's new and creative political status. The community of cooperation between the two countries was demonstrated when Governor Muñoz and President John F. Kennedy, on the 10th anniversary of the creation of the Commonwealth, recognized that the time had come to start new initiatives in order to enlarge Puerto Rico's political autonomy. A joint United States and Puerto Rican commission deliberated and studied the status between the two countries and came to the conclusion that the norms that govern the relations between the United States and Puerto Rico are based and always will be based on the principle of mutual consent and free determination. In addition, the Commission recommended the holding of a plebiscite to provide the people the opportunity to express their preference pertaining to political status. On this basis, a referendum was held on July the 23rd, 1967, in which Commonwealth, providing Puerto Rico broad political powers concomitant with common defense, economics, and citizenship, was voted for by 60.4% of the people. 38.9% preferred incorporation as a federal state, and the insignificant remainder voting for severing the structural ties with the United States. President Nixon and I, complying with the 1967 mandate, have appointed another joint United States-Puerto Rican Commission. It is presently at work refining the political formula chosen by both countries and recommending specific measures which would optimize Puerto Rico's self-determination. True economic development combines both greater growth and greater equity, by which the results of growth are widely distributed. Through open political processes, for 34 years, Puerto Rico has concentrated on raising the living conditions rapidly, freeing a majority of families in every municipality out of the depth of extreme poverty that was pervasive, taking Puerto Rico into the threshold of the developed countries of the world. In terms of Puerto Rico's quantitative accomplishments, the basic economic statistics are flattering. Taking 1971 World Bank figures, its latest comprehensive compilation shows Puerto Rico's gross national product at market prices amounting to $5.05 billion. During the last fiscal year, national product increased to $6.43 billion, a jump of 11% over the previous year. Our net income per capita is now $1,834, which represents more than six times that of the 1950 and three times the 1960 figure. When the Popular Party won in 1940, the per capita income of Puerto Rico was $147. This would be comparable to the per capita income of many Latin American countries today. Now, during those 34 years of development, through this experiment of Commonwealth, it has gone up to $1,834. To put these statistics into some perspective, a valid transcontinental comparison can be made with Singapore, another island country closely connected with its larger mainland neighbors. With 25% less people than Puerto Rico, Singapore's GNP at market prices in 1971 was $2,530,000,000, about 50% lower than ours, and its per capita income was at $1,200, one-third below that of Puerto Rico. Another comparison, our Caribbean neighbor, Cuba, had a GNP at the end of 1972 of $4.8 billion and a net income per capita of $545. The economic growth rate during the whole Castro era has been less than 2% per year. Now let's look at this in terms of what it has meant for the people themselves. The earning of the Puerto Rican salaried workers has increased dramatically during the last two decades, if we just compare with 1950 and the 50s and the 60s. From 1953 to 1973, the median weekly earnings for all wage and salary workers increased by 512%. From $13, the median weekly earnings, from $13 to $77 per week. Among major industry groups, percentage increases were as follows. In the services, it increased 667%. In manufacturing, 416%. In construction, 300%. Trade and transportation, 300%. Agriculture, 300%. Even after accounting for purchasing power loss during that period, the real income of the median worker showed a 330% increase. That is, from $13 to $43. The average hourly wage in manufacturing went up from 50 cents in 1953 to $2.07 in 1973. This rate was higher than that of any other country in Latin America. The rate in Argentina was 61 cents per hour, and even of France, where the rate was $1.71 in that year. A comparison of Puerto Rico's foreign trade with that of other Latin American countries enables us to better understand the strength of the Puerto Rican economy and the tremendous job of development which the Puerto Rican people have done over the past three decades. Puerto Rico, which in the 40s was called the poorhouse of the Caribbean with its $147 of per capita income, among the poorest of Latin American countries, now in 1974, with a population that we have now of 2,712,000, had more exports and imports in 1973 than Mexico, with a population of 55,867,000. Venezuela had more exports because of oil, but not more imports. Only Brazil, of all Latin American countries, with its 103 million inhabitants, had more exports and imports than Puerto Rico. In his book, Puerto Rico, Freedom and Power in the Caribbean, the British historian Gordon Lewis has written, Puerto Rico produces what she does not consume and consumes what she does not produce. On a more philosophical plane, compared to a generation ago, we have everything. Yet I wonder, do we have everything? Similar inquiries are being raised worldwide about the quality of the life standards and style man has created on his small planet. It is here that I want to take a look at another set of statistics which show a bleak side of Puerto Rico's economy. Puerto Rico has two basic limitations that are unchangeable. The island is physically small, only 100 miles long and 34 miles wide. It is distant from other sources of materials and markets. To offset these limitations, Puerto Rico must import most of the goods and products it needs, and even some of the services. In order to pay for these, it must produce and export necessarily a much narrower range of products and services, but in comparatively large volume and preferably at higher prices. Our exports of several hundred agricultural and industrial products, plus tourism and other services, must be of sufficient value to pay for the thousands of products and services that cannot be efficiently produced locally and yet are part of our high level of living. Our human resources, that is population density, the proportion of dependent children and young people, and a low employment rate among working age people have limited our economic growth. After the Second World War, overpopulation and underemployment or unemployment were alleviated by large numbers of Puerto Ricans emigrating to the United States. In the 1960s, however, the outflow was offset by a bigger inflow of returning Puerto Ricans plus Cuban refugees. The prevalence of people in Puerto Rico, especially in the crowded cities, retards development and dilutes many of development's gifts. With our natural wealth limited, it is necessary to maximize our manpower, our materials, and our minds. We need better trained laborers and workers with sophisticated skills, plus greater technological ingenuity, such as the Japanese and the Israelis have displayed. Puerto Rico needs a high rate of investment, both in capital goods and in education. Consumption expenditures are high because the number of dependents per worker is so large and because of the driving force of conspicuous consumption. This keeps personal savings at a low level and even at a negative level. Economic growth remains highly dependent on investment from external sources. Amounts invested in education are diluted by the large numbers of young people to educate, which in turn contributes to high dropout rates, especially beyond elementary school, and results in the present and future scarcity of the professional and trained personnel, technical personnel required in a high technology economy. I realize that such a set of mutually aggravating problems is not unique to Puerto Rico. With variations in detail, it is to be found in most developing countries and in backward areas within the United States as well. But Puerto Rico's situation is distinguished by the magnitudes involved in relationship to size. Our economists point out that the population pressure on our resources is unusually severe. The population structure is unusually distorted. Dependence on outside capital is unusually great, and educational requirements are unusually high. To produce a per capita level of income approaching that of the United States, for example, Puerto Rico would have to reach comparably full employment and a level of per worker output nearly double the United States average. This means that investment per worker would have to be much above the U.S. average and the labor force much better educated and more highly skilled than now. Puerto Rico's leadership needs to seize upon every opportunity to create jobs. However, at the same time, we must face up to the factors adding to the continuous increase in the numbers of employed Puerto Ricans, such as the high birth rate, which I mentioned before, and immigration. As a result of those born in 1957, when we had a birth rate of 35 per thousand, 28,000 persons entered the island's labor force this year. Added to this inordinate population growth during the last 2 years, Puerto Rico has had a net reverse migration, mostly Puerto Ricans coming back after having established themselves on the mainland. This represents an increase in the labor force also. Should this tendency prevail, our population will continue to boom. Population planning policy is clear and foremost in my thoughts, as I think it should be in the minds of other leaders in the developing world. Now, it was not my intention to saturate you with Puerto Rico's quantitative successes and shortcomings, but I think the extent of our economic growth should be duly noted. Within the parameters of this development, the most striking single change that has taken place in our society since 1940 is the emergence of a collective will to achieve. However, freedom's future depends more on the extent of our qualitative accomplishments than on the competitiveness of our society. More equally distributing our accumulated wealth, unjamming not only our traffic, but the stresses of our social structure as well, institutionalizing our total development processes so that the pursuit of our present priorities will lead to an economically sound and socially just society. Puerto Ricans want quality. The leadership is under pressure to produce plans and services in order to achieve the goals both of continuing economic growth and of realizing economic equity. My energies are devoted towards abolishing poverty and transcending wealth values, towards unleashing human potentials by encouraging everyone's participation, towards deepening the extent of human freedom on our small global spot. It is my belief that to realize a society of greater justice and equality, our dignity and worth as a people are on trial. So is government's worth as a structure of and for freedom. So is the preservation of Earth's essential life support systems of atmosphere and water. The future of economic development rests on the ability of our society to plan and to follow through on plans in a reasonably and flexible manner. The key is to integrate our objectives: full employment, a healthy and aesthetically appealing environment, quality education, and family planning. Creating jobs is fundamental. Encouraging industry to come into an area or expand its facilities needs to be thought out and regulated in terms of pollution control and population density, as well as the human skills necessary for running the operation. Educational training on and off the job, placing maximum limits on population, strict land use laws, deciding which kinds of manufacturing plants to attract, supplying sufficient fuel and social service requirements are all essential elements to be taken into account in any development planning. It is my desire to shape Puerto Rico in such a way that it becomes a highly integrated society and system, so that in case of conflicting demands among the various sectors of the economy, decision making will be based on serving the public interest of the society and of all Puerto Ricans as a whole, and not that of any particular social or economic sector. Only in an integrated political economic system work closely to each other. Persistence in maintaining sovereign pride without the reality of economic growth and equity only prolongs dependency. I am not advocating the establishment of economic zones of influence. That is more of the colonial mode of operation. But I am advocating genuine means of cooperation among countries, such as free associations, to enhance each other's needs and to assist in solving urgent problems. Puerto Rico's leadership, in its commitment to the peace and progress of and for the people, is pursuing in a democratic context human values, individual liberties, economic material well-being, equality of opportunity, spreading as widely as possible, increased income, and the quality of life. The world was always here. Assume responsibility in order to radically reorganize a society as a whole. Puerto Rico's leadership eagerly assumes responsibility to direct Puerto Rico to a decent and just present, and also the preservation of a viable hope for a decent and just future. That is our popular choice. That is the basis of our decisions of activity in the internal and international arena. For over a quarter of a century, Puerto Rico has learned a lesson which now should be a truism, at least it is to us, that if people, the impoverishment, both of, I mean, the, if people are to overcome the imprisonment, both of imperial dependency and the social scourge of poverty, as well as other forms of domination, only the people, fully aware of their circumstances, through their own imagination and interpretation of responsibility, can free themselves. The Brazilian bishop, Don Antonio Batista Fragoso, expressed this new direction, and I quote, "We do not need paternalistic redemption. We need conditions so that those who are now abandoned may free themselves from their own underdevelopment with their own united force. Human beings will not make the social investment needed to build a society if all they can see ahead is more economic servitude. Not only do people need a personal economic stake, but a sense of personal dignity as well. Paradoxically, freedom is the precondition for economic, because society depends upon the individual, and freedom is essential to personal development. A sense of community, will be heard and understood by our neighbors and others in the world at large. Puerto Rico's self and global interest is a greater degree of economic growth and social justice among all the peoples. Only then will the globe change, from Solzhenitsyn's deformed description of the world to that in which there is a chance for the whole human family to enjoy freedom and its multiple satisfactions. Thank you very much.